Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Now, I know I just played this about 30 minutes ago, maybe not even that, coming out of the last break. But I play this to intimidate Grant because he knows that I would kick his ass in a karaoke contest if I sang this. Okay, so it sets the tone for the next hour, just so that to remind him that I would crush his Toby Keith shit and knock his like lame ass Frank Sinatra shit right out of the karaoke bar. Someday we'll settle this. So joining me from Taipei, I think, is Grant Newsham. Grant, good morning. Good evening. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Are you sufficiently?
I'm not intimidated.
You're not intimidated. Oh, yeah. No. Bold talk from a one-eyed fat man there, Rooster.
Okay, fill your hand.
Fill your... Yeah. What's he say? Fill your hand, Ned?
That's right. You son of a bitch.
Right, one of the great scenes out of the movie True Grit, and then he's a big dude and he's riding that horse and he's shooting that rifle and then he like snaps it over his head to cock it. That was pretty manly of the Duke. Yes,
the whole thing is
it is a great scene. It is a great scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You used to see it at the basic school on a regular, on a fairly regular. It was one of the motivational clips I'd show you as a lieutenant before class back in the day. Okay, we've got a lot of shit to cover, so let's go right to it. First of all, I listened to Ambassador O'Brien. And he had some pretty interesting stuff to say about the United States and recently at his appearance at the Aspen Security Forum. And so did you have a chance to watch that? And if you did you find anything that broke squelch for you?
I thought it was – I did watch it. And I thought it was really a very good recap of what this administration – has accomplished. One thing that did jump out at me was, some of the things they've done that were thought impossible, in particularly involved in getting countries in the Middle East to recognize Israel. Also, they went over the range of things that they've been doing in regards to Asia. And it's been done quietly. It hasn't gotten much recognition, but I thought it was just the matter of factness about it all. And one thing that struck me was actually about him. You know, he's probably the least famous of the several national security advisors they've had, and in some ways he comes across maybe better than some. He had mispronounced a few words, which I'm sure the chattering class was tittering about. But he was on top of everything, and you see, he seemed to have a good sense of it all. And somehow, he's been paying attention, for a long time. So I was actually impressed with the presentation. And what'd you think?
No, I've heard. As I follow current events, that he's a very, very impressive person. And I've heard that from people from both political parties that people who said, I don't always agree with him, but I will tell you this. He's as good of a national security advisor as there's been in the last, 10 years. And so I hadn't listened to him in long format. I walked away from that absolutely impressed because I thought he was complete in his thoughts to include the challenges that still face. But at the same time, I mean, if you can imagine, not only one, but multiple. And what was the latest? Sudan is now going to reestablish diplomatic relations with Israel? I mean, this is stuff that we've never seen in our time, but as you said, largely not recognized because of, you know, Donald Trump being the president. Had Barack Obama done this stuff, right, there would have been a hue and clamor from the media that Barack Obama be given the Nobel Peace Prize at least once, possibly more than once, for these incredible things that he's made happen. And so I thought that was very, very interesting. Anything else relative to the Pacific Rim that got your attention that he said?
You know,
let me ask you this. Here's what got my attention. His discussion of the quote unquote he didn't say this, but I'll say this. Probably the most likely scenario in terms of Chinese aggression against Taiwan is the little green men, or whatever color they would be, kind of knocking off what the Russians did in Crimea relative to the Ukraine. So I'm curious about your thoughts of that. Do you see that as the most likely way that China would attempt to create more friction and ultimately say, you know, it's just better if we just are one and you just need to succumb to us? Do you see that as viable or not?
I do. First, I think that the National Security Advisor, I think he was on top of the issues. And he obviously knew the Taiwan matter very well, which means he's done his homework and others have educated him. So I don't think there's anything that would really surprise him. And his crowd, I do wish they would help the Taiwan military break out of its isolation and actually do something with them. Joint training on Guam, for example. We've talked about it before, but they still haven't been able to pull that off. Why, I don't know, but that's a big mistake. But back to your little green men scenario, that is part of the equation for Taiwan that doesn't get the attention it deserves. Because China is reliably believed to have fifth columnists, special forces in Taiwan, and they've been there for a long time, armed, ready to cause trouble, ready to assist other things the Chinese military would be doing. And that the chaos that's going to be sort of inflicted on the Taiwan citizenry and just the local situation is going to be immense. And that's, it doesn't get much attention. It deserves it. So, you know, that is, say, something that needs addressed. I don't know that the Taiwanese government has addressed it properly yet. I don't think they have. It's a tough thing to deal with, but nonetheless, it is important. And so that subversion and the political warfare, the gradual, and is going to happen. And as you mentioned, that it's the wearing down of the Taiwan people, the Taiwan government, to the point where, you know, you just don't feel like it's worth resisting. It's, you know, and you're not sure anybody's going to support you. You don't know if the Americans are really going to help you. That psychological part of the fight is one that is important, and I'd say as important almost as the military part, but it doesn't get the attention it really deserves.
What about, I'll tell you what was one of the stunning things that he said in this thing, and I'll put the link in this hour. So, I would tell you the Aspen Security Forum is a bipartisan or effort to have these kind of long format, you know, great discussions with people that are making policy and people that have made policy. I enjoy the hell out of them. When he said there was probably more Chinese PLA officers studying STEM subjects, right? Science, math, right? Technology subjects in the United States than there in United States universities. So there was more Chinese PLA officers studying STEM in American universities than there were American officers. I think that's stunning.
Oh, I did too. And if you get beyond just the military part of it, the number of Chinese studying it in America, period, not just studying it, but very serious researchers at the high end. And you look at the major sort of scientific developments in the IT or technology fields when they get announced. It'll be some team from, you know, say Yale or Berkeley or wherever. And there's always, you know, two or three mainland Chinese who are in on it. And it is, there's a lot of them. And they're, you know, it's not like these people are just as smart as anyone. And, you know, they've got a good platform from which to learn, get technology, take it back to China, weaponize it, commercialize it. And that's been going on for, you know, 30 years probably. It really is nothing new. It's just, you'll notice it's just coincidentally in about the last 3 years, somebody started to highlight it. You know, one thing I would note about the National Security Advisor's talk is that if you listen to other National Security Advisors, I mean, over the years, I mean, go back to the Clinton administration or even beyond, you know, to the Bush-Reagan administrations, a lot of them, when they talk, they always talk about how hard everything is, how complex and complicated. And they never really talk about how they're going to fix things, much less how they have fixed things. And yet with O'Brien's talk, you know, you noted that, you know, these guys have gotten a lot done. That is one thing that did jump out at me. You know, he was, you know, a guy that, you know, said he's good, you know, that was able to rattle off a list of accomplishments. And you just don't see that. This wasn't just the, you know, the pontificating and the sort of the up in the air,
bloviating nonsense of a guy holding a bag for a politician.
Yeah, you know, talking about problems, admiring them, and how explaining to each other why they're so complicated and why they can't be fixed. And this O'Brien's talk was very different, and that is one of the things that that did strike me. But your anecdote about the STEM issue with the way that the Chinese Communist Party people have managed to really get in there. Do they dominate it? I don't know, but pretty close to it. And we've basically handed this stuff, been handing it over unchecked for at least 20 years, probably longer.
Well, he made that the largest, what did he say, the largest technological transfer in the history of the planet has gone on between the United States, you know, illegally between the United States and China over the course of the last X number of years, 20 years.
Yeah, and that's a transfer of wealth,
right?
Ultimately, we just might as well have gone emptied out Fort Knox and, you know, our top 1,000 banks and just, you know, shipped it over to China. And that is, it's made a very small number of people very rich, but that's about all it's done.
All right. Let me next subject. U.S.-India intel sharing, significant or not?
Oh, I think it is. It's, you know, it moves things forward. You know, any time that you help people with intelligence, it changes the relationship. You know, when you're able to sort of open, you know, share a secret with somebody, you know, assuming everything else is right, that it does change the way you look at each other. You know, we look at them as more of a reliable ally, and they look at us in a similar way. And it's a good thing, I think, operationally, in terms of what it tactically or allows you to do. That'd be an improvement for India's capabilities. So it's part of a larger improvement in the India-China relationship, India-U.S. relationship, in the last few years by coincidence, which, if you know, you remember it from 30 years ago, you know, India was just too much trouble. It was aligned with aligned with Russia, just impossible to do anything with. And it's gotten better over the years. It didn't. It has improved gradually in recent times, but it's really gotten much better just in the last few years. It's still got a ways to go, of course, but you know, for once, people can actually talk about India as a possible partner, if not ally, in the, you know, what we've got going in the Indo-Pacific to really promote the free, protect the free world's interests.
China, India, the United States, Australia, and Japan will conduct a naval exercise here shortly. Talk to me about that. Is that significant? Is that something that has been going on? Is it growing? Is it more significant because of my own opinion is that there is no path to I won't even say confrontation with China. I will say to deterrence with China without our allies. And those four countries are, I mean, the major players in the region. It would be nice to get Vietnam and the Philippines to participate in that, but we'll get to that in a few minutes. The significance of this exercise coming up, or is it?
Oh, it's significant. You're right that we cannot, we can't win in the Indo-Pacific or anywhere else, you know, without some decent allies that can pull their weight and can fight. We can't do it by ourselves. It's anywhere. And that's what the really advantage of this so-called Quad, the Japanese, Australians, and Indians, and us getting together and starting to act like partners and getting out and do things. Hopefully there'll be an economic component to this as well. But the military is always the easiest thing to get running. I'm partly the nature of just military guys know how to go out and do stuff. But this, the particular exercise you mentioned, it's called Malabar, and it's been going on for a while, but it's always involved the U.S., India, and Japan. And Australia was invited around 2007. They were allowed to participate. They did participate. And the Chinese complained. And the Australians actually pulled out. They pulled out of the exercise. So they haven't participated since 12, 13 years or so. And partly that was because the Prime Minister of Australia at the time, Kevin Rudd, was basically kind of like a Chinese appeaser. He didn't want to get China angry, and the Indians got a little jumpy too because they have their own equivalent of accommodationists. So the Australians haven't been part of it, and now it's been very publicly announced that they are going to be invited back, and Australia has said yes, we're glad to be here, and there's even talk of having the Australians and Indians cooperating. Some more sort of intelligence operational work in the sort of the Eastern Indian Ocean, and an American P-8, I think it was an anti-submarine airplane, actually stopped and refueled in the Indian base in Port Blair in the Andaman Islands, which is just the eastern part of the Indian Ocean near the Straits of Malacca. And the Indians have always been very sensitive about those bases. And they've allowed the Japanese to use them, actually, but the Americans, not so much. And this is considered a step ahead as well. One sort of funny anecdote is when, I forget when it was. I think it was may have been after the 2007 or Malabar exercise. That was it was a very successful one. And it was considered successful, at least, because it went off smoothly and everyone had a good barbecue at the end. And the U.S. Navy commander, at the end of it, he announced, and he started talking like, this is the great of a wonderful, wonderful relationship. We're going to go from strength to strength. You know, the U.S., India, Australia, Japan alliance, it's the future. And he said that, and as soon as he said it, you knew that the Indians were going to pull back.
Right.
And sure enough, they did. You know, it'd be like going out on if you went out on a date with a girl, and she, after the first date, she announces you're engaged and you're going to get married and have six children and this and that. And that was this, U.S. Navy admiral who should have known better. you know, as people sometimes want to do, he jumped the gun a bit. And that actually set the relationship, the military relationship, back some measurable amount. Right. Sometimes you got to go slow and, you know, don't talk about things. But I just threw that in because I remember it very well, because you knew as soon as he said it what was going to happen. And sure enough, it did.
No, it's interesting. And again, for those, I mean, if you've been around for more than, you know, a couple years, you know that India keeps a respectful distance when it comes to the United States. It clearly sees that it has an independent tack to run relative to the United States and the Soviet Union back in the day. And so I would we're advising people, don't get over your skis, because all you're going to do is you're going to give them cause to create space. You know, just, you know, be polite, say the right things in public about, you know, and it was a great step. We enjoy working as always with, you know, the professionals in the Indian military, and hope to do so more of it in the future. I mean, don't scare them. Don't talk about marriage on the first date. You could see that. But again, I think the India piece, along with the intel sharing, along with what's going on their border, I mean, when you begin to put these pieces together, I mean, hopefully what you see is allies acting in concert that will begin to be the, you know, the first steps of a coordinated response that says, you know what, we're not interested in moving away from a rules-based order. And so let me, you know, two more steps into that. United States, the State Department just approved Harpoon missiles to Taiwan. What is the Taiwanese reaction to that? And is this a case of we're selling them our B-level hardware that we know the Chinese can defeat, but it makes them feel good about themselves. It makes us look like we're supporting them. Tell me where this lands and all of that.
No, this is a serious sale. You know, it does help if you can get the hardware there quickly and not have the delivery, you know, 4 or 5 years from now. But this is serious. It's a good weapon, and particularly it's mobile. You can't – it's hard to target, hard to find, easy to hide. And it's a fairly narrow battle space that, you know, we're talking about, and that it's, you know, the Strait of – the Taiwan Strait is only – about 100 miles wide. And so you say that's fairly narrow, and you can reach into China a bit as well, if where the staging areas, et cetera. So it really is a good piece of hardware. You know, and goes along with these long-range air-launched missiles that were approved just the other day, the other week, HIMARS.
Right.
Marines would be familiar with. Those have been approved for sale. And to give you an idea of just how really they tried to keep Taiwan on a leash, really so the State Department could say it was helping Taiwan defend itself, is the, you know, when you used to go to visit Taiwan military, they would have surface air missiles, you know, like a Strela or whatever they call the Stinger.
Right.
However, these surface to air missiles were actually not shoulder fired. It was required that they be put on like a concrete block and operated from that. The idea being you can't move them around, and thus the Taiwanese won't be tempted to, you know, to get uppity. And, you know, who knows what they might do to provoke the Chinese. And so that was the requirement put on by the Americans to sell them these, you know, these small surface-to-air missiles, is to make them immobile.
Right.
And that is gives you a pretty good idea how things were and what the mindset was. And that now you look at what's being sold, and it's a different way of looking at the problem, and this looks like more real American support. So it's a good thing. Of course, the like any military at the top levels, there's a tendency to get the top leaders of a certain sort who have gotten promoted where they are by thinking a certain way, doing certain things, and they get kind of comfortable with it. And what is required now, however, is a complete repurposing of Taiwan's military and of its defense strategy. And not all the top leaders understand the importance of this, or even how to go about it, or even willing to just turn it over to somebody younger and saying, look, here's what we need. We'll figure out what we need and let's get it done and I'll support you. One, you've got, for example, that some of the Taiwan services, you know, with everything that's going on with Chinese, you know, airplanes, aircraft, you know, threatening Taiwan, naval maneuvers, combined arms maneuvers, all intended to intimidate. The services have been given orders to prepare for a massive drum competition. I'm not making this up.
Come on.
And that's the orders come down from the very top. You know, it's going to have the battle of the drums and the drum teams. And, you know, you can do one thing or you can do the other. You can defend yourself or you can be, you know, like a sort of a Ringo Starr in uniform. And that's something that the serious Taiwan military people have to deal with is really, unfortunately, at the top level. And not everyone is really thinking the way they ought to be.
All right. I think one of the most interesting things I've seen, and potential because of its potential, is this. The United States has already sent one, and it will send two additional U.S. Coast Guard cutters to be based out of Guam to enforce maritime law of the sea rights in the Western Pacific. So in my mind's eye, when I read that, I'm thinking, biggest violators are China. They prey in the Philippines on their in their economic exclusion zone, which, you know, the law of the sea recognizes. You have 12-mile territorial limit and then 12-mile other something else, another area. And then, but out to 200 miles, you have the exclusive right to the minerals and the fishing rights and everything that exists in the sea. That belongs to you by UN treaty. What make you of that? How, you know, I could see this in the Senkaku Islands with the Coast Guard, which has law enforcement ability at sea that the Navy does not. I could see this leading to confrontation. I'm curious about your thoughts about it.
Well, if you stand up for yourself, the possibility of confrontation is always there. And what you've got is it's a Chinese fishing fleets that are huge. And we're talking hundreds of ships, and they operate with impunity anywhere they want. And they pretty much dare anybody to do anything about it. And there isn't a single Coast Guard or maritime police anywhere, except maybe us, that can take them on. These Chinese ships are built for ramming. Many of them are armed. They're able to swarm an opponent, sink them, ram and sink them. And I haven't even mentioned the Chinese Coast Guard, which has, you know, ships that could take on some of our destroyers. That's the problem that you've got, is these Chinese fishing vacuum cleaners pretty much sailing around the world anywhere they want. And it's a problem not just in the Pacific, you know, all along the coast of Africa. They've got the problem recently in South America, Ecuador, Chile. They're faced with these Chinese fishing locusts. And it's literally everywhere, and it's doing its best to empty out the seas. So putting the Coast Guard out in the Pacific it's a good step of showing that you're going to try to do something about it. You're going to try to help our friends rein this in a bit. And that's a good thing. Of course, the Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard, only has so many ships. And it's a fairly small service. So that's, it's not like the game's over. But there's a lot more that needs to be done. And once again, it's another manifestation of just how we ignored the problem for so long. And really, fishing is in the Pacific is probably, it's one of the very few sort of profitable enterprises or industries that many of these small island nations have. And if you can't control it, then, you know, what you, somebody else is taking, really taking your money, taking your stuff. And it's if you deplete the stocks, and that's how the Chinese do work, and they overfish and overfish, you're going to leave these people even more destitute than they already are. So putting the Coast Guard out once again, is there some reason this couldn't have been ago? Well, the answer is no. And once again, well, under whose administration is it happening? There's also talk of stationing Qatar down in American Samoa. Which would be a good thing. It's a little far, it's a little out of the way. But nonetheless, that would be something new. It would be good to give American Samoa some attention, for one thing. But you can't have enough Coast Guard ships or Coast Guard presence in the Pacific. So this is, once again, a very good step.
So do you see this as – so there's a bit of a kerfuffle in the Western Pacific about fishing rights. And now you have the United States, let's just say the United States and Vietnam's Navy confronting Chinese fishing vessels, and that confrontation then going where? To that Law of the Sea Court at The Hague, and hauling the or before the United Nations and hauling China before them? Is that what you see this as, the first step in a progress that seeks to drag the Chinese before another international tribunal, this time with instead of individual support, say the Philippines v. China, this would be regional support with America behind it? How do you see it playing out?
Well, you could take a sort of a legal approach to it, and that, you know, it might not be it's not a bad thing to pursue if you can do it without detracting from anywhere else. And as you mentioned, there is precedent for suing China over its behavior on the high seas when the Philippines did it in 2000 after Scarborough Shoal 2014 or right. So, and they hired very good lawyers and did an excellent job, and they won overwhelmingly. The decision was 98% in their favor. China simply ignored it. And the Obama administration, they didn't just ignore it. They actually said this is the ruling is a piece of trash paper. And the Obama administration said nothing. They did nothing to defend the Filipinos, and everything has gone downhill from there in terms of our position in Asia and how we're regarded. So if you sue the Chinese fishing industry, lawyers getting $1,000 an hour would be glad to take it on,
right?
Because there's a lot of work to it. It's a complex and lengthy sort of approach, and you might do it. Not least, it does. There's an embarrassment factor when most of the Pacific Island nations are suing China. There's an embarrassment, and even the Chinese have their limit. It's a pretty tall one for getting embarrassed, but they don't like to be thought of as uncivilized. As these sort of, and though how much they really mind it, I don't really know. But they don't like the bad publicity, so that could be part of it. But you do have to have an enforcement mechanism, not just enforcement, but simply standing up for what's yours. If you sort of hire a watchman to. Or start walking your property to make sure that, like, nobody's digging it up. Are you being provocative? No. So what we're doing needs to be viewed as protecting existing lawful interests of the regional nations, not cracking down on China and Chinese fishing boats. That may be part of the equation, but in terms of the reason for what's being done and how it should be characterized, it needs to be depicted as sort of lawful enforcement and protection of one's own property. And the island nations need the help. They just don't have the capability, the ships, the hardware. They could use the know-how. And you need intelligence as well. If you're going out looking for fishing boats, It's a big ocean. Fishing boats are small, even a couple hundred of them working together with their transponders turned off. That somebody's got to help them with the whole maritime security package. And that's where the Americans, the Australians, the Japanese should be working together on this. You know, I'm sure it's being given some thought, but one of these things, it's easy to say, it's hard to put into practice. Not that it should be, but it's taken a while to bring that to fruition.
Interesting. Here's an email. Mac, I'm curious. Will the U.S. ever adopt a whole-of-government approach to China where we see more efforts like this? I see the military effort as one prong of this. The State Department and the diplomatic efforts, I think, should also catch up to the military to include the State Department as the lead for our economic efforts there, which I think will ultimately strengthen the relationships. But it seems to call for an all of government. The Coast Guard piece to me is interesting. I had not heard about it. But I believe that it is another piece in assembling the narrative that the world needs to see how broadly the Chinese are attempting to usurp the order. Are we any closer, do you think, to having a whole of government approach to dealing with this issue? Grant, your thoughts?
The emailer is correct, and that's what's needed. You know, otherwise I might compare it to, say, a military operation where all you're using is some infantry and some tanks, and that's it. Well, you know, what about like supporting fires and, you know, logistics and supply and medical and all the intelligence, all these other things that you need? And that's pretty much how we've been doing it, is we, you know, rely on the military and thinking that's going to solve the problem. But this is one, the economic angle is as effective as the military. When you apply the two together, it gets even better. And for some reason, no administration has been able to pull that off. But you do hear the word whole of government approach. You hear it all the time. Right. And it's like a mantra. And but it's never said by anybody who's really got an interest or a requirement to actually produce. Once again, it's the people who lovingly admire the problems and talk about how hard they are and can say, we need a whole of government approach. Okay, well, what are you going to do? You say you don't see, you know, where is the economic component of our effort to protect and promote our interests? People say, well, the Department of Commerce does stuff. You know, they promote imports and exports. And U.S. Trade Representative brings suits against people who cheat. You know, they bring them with the WTO, and it takes 10 years to solve one. But you don't really see our economic power being marshaled and employed in an effective way that bolsters us and our allies and disadvantages our enemies. And could it be done? Yes. And there's some people who know how to do it, want to do it, but even this administration hasn't been able to really get that going, though it has done some things, particularly in the International Development Finance Corporation or whatever it's called, to sort of promote an alternative to the Belt and Road Initiative that uses, American and free world resources for infrastructure development around the world. And that's gotten off the ground. It has to get up some speed, however. The trade pressure that's been put on China, that's, you might say, is part of an effort to use the whole of government, the economic angle. So there have been things that have been done, but it hasn't been put together in a systematic whole. This administration has actually, you know, done some work on the sort of using strategic communications, you know, just calling China, an adversary, a competitor, what have you, just suggesting it's not a great friend is a step in the right direction. They've done some things, but there's a lot more that can be done, needs to be done. You know, it's hard to imagine you know, a successful outcome to this if it relies exclusively on trying to counter China's military power. It will not succeed. It has to include an economic angle, a propaganda angle, a financial angle. And as long as you've got Wall Street pouring tens, hundreds of billions of U.S. dollars into China every year and stymieing every administration's efforts to actually do something about China, that is hard to see how we're going to succeed. But the email is right on the money.
In terms of whole of government approach.
Yeah, and I wish there was another word, because it's one of these ones that you say it so you'll get a good fitness report.
Right.
You know, like the guy who nods his head during the brief, you know, so, and make sure the general can see him nodding his head.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's kind of how it is. You know, people say it, and then, okay, what did you do to make it happen? Nothing. We need a whole of government approach.
Right.
So unfortunately, and that sounds a little harsh, but
that's true.
You know, somebody show me I'm wrong.
Well, no. And again, I think the whole of government, as you just alluded to, the whole of government approach is thwarted by the economic incentive to do business in China. Right. I mean, one of the things that was interesting about Ambassador O'Brien's remarks was, the United States is one of the few countries on the planet that is casting, right, what the Chinese are doing with the Uyghurs, right, shaving the hair of Uyghur women, using it for products that they're selling, that they're then exporting around the world. And the United States, with its Department of Homeland Security and other enforcement mechanisms, intercepting this stuff and saying, yeah, it's not coming in our country. But, you know, and trying to shame Germany into saying the same things. Well, Germany hasn't taken a public position relative to what's going on there. So it's like you're thwarted with this whole of government approach, because there's other incentives here at work, and nobody really wants to upset the gravy train too much. You know, it's this whole, you know, well, maybe if we look the other way, we could still do business there. The NBA's approach. Right, to business. We just won't look at Hong Kong. We won't look at, you know, concentration camp for Muslims. Let's just not acknowledge it, and we'll just keep making our billions of dollars out of China. And that's – so, I mean, there's this active component that works against a whole-of-government approach. And seeing it for what it is, and then, you know, and then having policies that deal with it. So – yeah, I we can fawn over it, we can wring our hands, but we really don't want to do anything at the end of the day, because there's just too much money to be made there.
Yeah, that is what it is. And one would say it's nothing new, I suppose, but this seems different for some reason. I mean, they just unrestrained willingness to tolerate just the worst evils because you can make some cash out of it. And you mentioned the hair, the fake hair that's come out of the Uyghur prison camps. And to you and I, this, what we think of as goodness, this is like those pictures you would see of, like, from the German extermination camps, where they would shave Jewish people's hair and sell it. You know, their teeth, their skin, the shoes, the clothes, everything. The whole thing is so repulsive to people like us that I can't conceive of how anybody could possibly do business with that regime that's doing this. And supposedly it was supposed to be, you hear that expression, never again, never again.
Right.
Well, we're doing it again and nobody cares. And you'd look at the people who are really the big wigs in these investments and pouring our money into China. These are people who ought to have some personal interest in what happened to the Jews in the during the Germans' extermination effort in the 30s and 40s. It's just astonishing. I mean, go down the list of the people who are leading the rush into China now, and I have no idea what they're thinking. The word amoral comes immediately to mind. This is something that is just hard to look at, and you wonder, how can we possibly succeed when such an important part of our our power, you know, the financial end of it, is hopelessly subverted. So I don't know how that's going to play out. I would support any administration that was willing to crack down on these people. But and even and this administration knows the problem, but even they have not been able to rein in the Quislings, these people who are really selling out their countrymen for cash, a lot of cash.
Well, in terms of, you know, defining the problem, which brings us to your piece that was published yesterday in AND magazine. China doesn't want deals; it wants domination. And there's a claw of a looks like a some kind of dragon with claws and kind of the dragon teeth on the arm, and the it's red. And it has the emblem of the flag of the of China, and getting ready to claw itself into the earth. Talk to me about the article. What's the premise of the article?
The premise is that what we've got going on against and with China is it's an existential fight. It's not one of these sort of like, uncomfortable and sort of irksome sort of affairs like we've had with Cuba for a long time, or even Iran. It's not fun and it's a lot of trouble, but, we're not going to lose. And at the end of the day, we could probably finish it off if we felt like it. But you don't really, isn't a threat to your survival. And what I'm saying, that's how China has been considered. And remember, for as we've discussed many times, for a long time, you couldn't even say it was we had any problems at all with China. What we've got now is a war or conflict. It's not a shooting war yet, but it's a conflict that we could lose. And how you read a lot of history and you wonder, boy, what was it like, back when, the Turks were outside of Vienna, trying to take Vienna and then move into the rest of Europe, or the Mongols pouring out of the east and, taking, capturing and killing and burning and looting, etc. Everything else they wanted to, and nobody seemed like they could stop them. It must have seemed like to people alive then that they were faced with the fight of their lives, and if they lost, the game would be over for them. And that's my article, is that we kind of are in that kind of a fight. I would take out kind of. We are in that kind of a fight, and what China is seeking to do is to dominate us. It's not as if they're going to, land troops in, Carlsbad and take them up the five, but it's they dominate us and use this combination of technology, big data, AI, sort of a military that can operate globally. You've got long range missiles that can hit anything on Earth. You're going to dominate. You're trying to dominate outer space, cyberspace. Economic coercion, and with that you can get control over people. You can get them to do what you want, think what you want, and look at the self-censorship that Americans already do, not to offend China, and China isn't even getting started. So that's my.
Well, let me ask you. Yeah. Somebody just sent this. One of the scary parts of the hedge fund managers dealing with China is many of them don't know how to find it on a map and know nothing of the history. Do you believe that, or do you believe they could find it on a map and they do know the history, they just don't care because all of that is subordinate to their profit?
I would have to say the latter. What I would say, if you think once a historical example, the people who collaborated with the Germans in France, and I use the word Quisling, that word for German collaborator with the Norwegian leader, Vidkun Quisling. There were always people in these free countries who were willing to sell out. And that's what these people are. They've all got an excuse, as to why it's not that bad, why it's actually a good course of action. They can all rationalize it, or say not all of them, but some of them actually kind of know that for like a fleeting second that they shouldn't be doing this. But most of them, I think they're what we would call traitors. you know, and that to me, that's I think what we're seeing it on display. I don't think they really don't know what's going on or the nature of this regime, but they've been able to convince themselves that what they're doing is okay. That's my sense of it. You probably find examples of each, but I would say more in the latter would be my
My sense of it. Again, it's just like the NBA's behavior. It's not like they don't know. It's not like they can't read. It's not like it's not all over the place. It is not in their financial interest to go anywhere near that, and so they don't. They just click to mute, and you know, and they continue on. And hopefully, this will get smoothed out. Blah 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 blah. So to me, it's way worse than ignorance. It is the willful compliance for my economic benefit, and that's again, just to go to double back it. That's what thwarts, you know, the olive government approach. Because wait a minute. There's way too much money to be made there. Now, let me ask you this. You kind of in the article, there's a series of assertions in bold, and then you discuss them underneath that. Let me throw a couple of these out at you. The PRC has pulled off the biggest, fastest military expansion since World War II, if not in history. Talk about that.
Well, the one example is that the Chinese Navy is now bigger than the U.S. Navy, and by the end of the decade, it will be two times as large. For the last decade or so, the Chinese have been launching five ships for every one ship the Americans launch. The Chinese are building nuclear submarines that will have global reach, just an incredibly fast rate. They have pretty much no limits on the amount of resources they will put into defense. They don't really have a defense budget. That's just made for Western consumption. But they see any money that goes into defense as being for the national good, and they will put anything necessary into defense. So you look at where they were 20 years ago, where they are today, and your jaw drops. You have to admire it. Look at where they were 30 years ago, and it's hard to hard for a lot of people to imagine. It's not hard for anybody who understood something of the nature, and I would say of one, the communist regime, but also Chinese people at large. I mean, with the industriousness that you knew what was coming, but there were plenty of reasons not to think so. So that is, and their ground forces, their air forces, it's all improving, you know, and what they've set about is to have their own version of the U.S. military. You know, they see how we operate and they see where we operate everywhere on Earth. And that's what they've set about to do. Is it going to take them a little while to get there? Yes, probably 20, 30 years maybe, but they do everything faster than we expect. And when you consider where they were and where they are now, this is, I would say, it's the fastest buildup in history.
Formidable but not omnipotent, if I say that correctly. And you talk about some of their vulnerabilities as a nation. Talk about choking off the full of dollars to the PRC. How would the United States do that?
Make it against the law to invest in China or without close government scrutiny. This is sort of what we've been talking about just right now, is you prevent our Wall Street class, financial class, from pouring U.S. dollars into China. And that's their huge vulnerability, is that the Chinese currency is not of any good, enough any good outside of China, hardly. So it's like Jefferson Davis trying to pay for things in Confederate dollars. And the British were telling him, if you want Enfield rifles, it's Yankee greenbacks that we're going to need. And if you don't have the convertible currency that people want, you can't buy stuff. And China does need to buy a lot of things from overseas, food for one thing. And so that you see as a potential vulnerability. If you turn it around and suppose nobody wanted the U.S. dollar, think of how we would be grubbing to try, all of us, trying to find some money somebody wanted so we could buy stuff. And that is, a huge weakness. Their economic vulnerability is one of them. Geography is another. It's not, one, they don't grow enough food to feed themselves because the land isn't good enough. But the, also geographically, they've, if you look at the map, there's sort of a first island chain just off of China that kind of hems them in.
Right.
And then there's a second island chain. So it's be like to get out to the ocean. You have to go through these narrow straits that an adversary could close off or without a whole lot of effort. So if, imagine leaving San Diego and having to fight your way through narrow straits and then another set of narrow straits and islands that, you know, anti-ship missiles are coming in like, you know, like fire, like a fly. You know, they're just shooting. It's a web, a network that could be very hard to get through. And so that's not in their favor as well. So if the free nations of Asia can keep their acts to get their acts together, geography doesn't work in China's favor at all. And it has the problems that any sort of government based on oppression has, and that, you know, people act like they support it and you know, really committed to it, but it creates. I use the word brittleness. These regimes tend to come down pretty quickly when something goes wrong. You know, people don't eat for a week and they start to get your ability to oppress them starts to diminish once they start getting out of control. And also I cite an example that just about every Chinese person who can, and particularly the very top leaders, have for years been trying to get their money out of China, put it into a country like America, like the UK, Australia, Canada, democracies where they have property rights protected. And that suggests, like a futures market, it suggests that the people benefiting most from the Chinese system aren't that sure about its prospects. You don't see America's elite, putting their own money into China. That should tell you something. Or trying to get a relative with a green card to live in China, you know, buying property in China. Now they just want to put somebody else's money in there and get a cut of the action.
Right.
So those are things that, you know, are ultimately pretty serious weaknesses for the Chinese.
Communist Party. Talk to me about one of the things I thought was interesting in the article was foreign real estate and green cards. You just alluded to, you know, parking your money, Chinese, you know, attempting to get their money out, and, you know, pretty safe investments when you invest in real estate in the free nations of the world. Green cards, time-honored insurance policies for Chinese elites. Explain that.
Once again, people are so uncertain about the prospects of, you know, of the Communist Party that they have, you know, they want to get a bolt hole, you know, overseas, someplace where just in case things go bad, they can go and live. And it's a, apparently, like, huge number of Chinese top people have relatives with, you know, green cards or residence permits in, you know, Vancouver, Sydney, New York, Los Angeles, etc. And that's been is nothing new. That's been going on for a long time. And that too, you know, I would like to see an administration start canceling a few of these green cards and seizing some bank accounts until people can prove the money was lawfully exported. And because in China, you're only allowed to export $50,000 a year. Now, how you would buy, a house for $2 million,
yeah.
I don't know. So this is things that we should be doing. It's better than the alternative of going to war. And you have to make the sort of the pain, it has to be individual and personal for the top people in that system, because otherwise they're glad to let, you know, regular Chinese people absorb any amount of punishment. So whenever, like at Paycom, they used to talk about imposing costs on China, you used to wonder just, you know, whether these guys graduated from fifth grade or not, because there's no amount of punishment, that a cost that the Chinese people cannot absorb and that their leaders won't let them absorb. So I always thought that was sort of the wrong way to look at the problem. And there are probably people who understood that too.
Got it. Americas, you outline Americas. Talk to me about America's great weakness. What is it?
We've talked about it for a good bit of the show.
Our own greed and our own capitalist system.
You know, that's the Wall Street class, financial class, and the business. I call it the CEO class and CFO class that are out for one big payday and are willing to sell out to China or think they're going to get fabulously wealthy there. That's, I think, our biggest. That is our biggest problem. The other is the absolute venom that you see in our society today. I've never seen hatred like this, and I don't think a country can successfully resist a power like the People's Republic of China when it's this divided. And I say this isn't just good natured or sort of the usual kind of. Sort of argument. This is hatred to the point it seems like half of America would like the other half to die.
Have you seen the documentary The Social Dilemma?
No.
It's on Netflix. I would recommend. And it's very interesting in that some of these people are people that, you know, were in on the ground floors of organizations, companies like Google, Facebook, Pinterest, and a host of others. And they begin to walk you through social media, what it does, how it manipulates you, what you see, and you can see how it lends itself to there isn't a set of facts that form the truth anymore. You hear this phrase, "my truth," more and more. Like, what the fuck is that? My truth. But you can see how it's engineered deliberately for profit. So very much a very similar vein. And I would encourage, I don't recommend that many things from those platforms, but I'll tell you what, it's shocking, I think, to watch it and to hear these people explain how you're manipulated, how your children are manipulated, the lack of regulation to it, and where this is taking us. And when you see those people say that I don't allow my children, absolutely not. They were adamant. No. Social media, no. I limit their use of that device if they have them at all. And these people are the founders of that industry. So it's a fascinating look into the manipulative capabilities of these platforms. And that you, as you watch it, you can see, right? You can see how if you're not an inquisitive person who seeks out opposing viewpoints on issues, you can see how I don't want to say intellectual polarization, but it's somewhat, there's elements of intellectual polarization. And so that now, instead of my being a reporter and the critical importance of that to a democracy, what you have is reporters now believe that they should be advocates who subscribe to the narrative of their newspaper. And so if you're a reporter for the New York Times, your reporting function is subordinate to your function as a corroborator of the narrative. And so in Philadelphia in the last 48 hours, you have two police officers confront somebody with a knife. It's the third call that Philadelphia police officers have made. They do not have tasers. The guy is clearly disturbed. But with the knife, he advances on them to attack them. And they shoot and kill him. Well, now the narrative is cops once again have gunned down an innocent black man in West Philadelphia. And you don't see the pushback of the police department, and you just watch it, and it's head scratching. And when the truth is clearly apparent by the video that was shot, and then once a few other facts, and you know, Grant, you've been around bad things that have happened in the Marine Corps, within a half a dozen hours, you have 90% of the story, right? There might be nuances that you need the investigation to play out, but you know pretty much what happens. I won't even say within 6 hours, within probably 2 or 3 hours, you have the majority of the facts, you know, that are material to the case, and yet you don't see it. And so, again, I would, it's called The Social Dilemma on Netflix, and I agree. And what was interesting at the end of that, they asked them, well, where does this all take us? And you had some of them say civil war, the destruction of democracies and free nations, because totalitarian nations aren't subject to this because they control it all. Free nations are. And that's what's at stake here. So I thought it was a fascinating look, and from people that aren't, you know, overly political people, they're technology people. And so I would recommend it to you, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts after you watch it. So,
oh boy, that'll cheer me up.
It's straight up disturbing.
Yeah, you can't, you know, if you look at historic examples, and you can't think of one where a sort of a country has defended itself or a nation has defended itself when it was not unified. I mean, when it was fighting with itself, they always lose, and that was actually worked to the advantage. And I cited the Mongols and the Turks way back when. In both cases, Europe could not get its act together. You know, it had powerful resources, but the nations wouldn't cooperate. The kingdoms is the better way to put it, and they were fighting with each other. A bunch of them even joined the attackers. So you've got to have some sort of basic national unity and a sense that what you're defending is worth fighting. That so, and there's sort of a belief on sort of part of our political class that it's not worth defending what we have. It's, right, you know, an evil system that needs replaced, et cetera, et cetera. It makes it harder. And so this is I use the word epochal, which I looked it up several times to make sure I was using it right. And I think that's what we're seeing. You know, you kind of wonder if you're going to live through this kind of historic circumstances. And I think we are. And that's what I tried to get across in the piece.
Got it. You say that, and I'll quote the article, Mr. Trump seems to figured it out, seems to have figured it out. Mr. Biden, one hopes. And then you talk about an epic mistake that the polls made relative to the Mongols. How close are we to a point from which we cannot pull back? I mean, I'm extremely encouraged with the movement of India, the intel sharing agreement, I think is a good thing, but it creates closer ties. The naval exercises is an outward manifestation of that. An economic agreement, a series of them, I think are needed. What happened in Palau, the Coast Guard heading to the Pacific, I think those are all positive steps. The arms sales to Taiwan. That at least we seem to be waking up. Is there anything that would indicate that Mr. Biden will follow the same course? Have you seen, I mean, I'm sure people in your neck of the woods are attempting to read the tea leaves. Have there been any signals that he sees it, he understands it, and, you know, if he becomes a president, that would continue? Or is that shoe left to fall?
I think there's a lot of concern throughout Asia.
That we will go back to the policies of Barack Obama.
I'm afraid that's so. And people aren't keen to say it out loud.
Right.
But I think that is a concern, I think, from one end of Asia to another. No matter what the elites will tell you, that's the elites generally complain about all sorts of things and blame the Americans for this or that. But they've been doing that all the time. But if you talk to the more thoughtful people, that there's real concern that this trend, this move to stand up to China will not last. And that is, I think, is a real possibility. You know, we do know, we have a good sense of some of the people who will have foreign policy jobs in a Biden administration. And so they've got track records, and there's nothing in those that would give one much confidence. I think the optimist might say, well, they've learned their lesson, things have changed, they're going to be harder on China. But I don't know. You know, if you haven't done your job very well in the past, it's hard to think that you're going to do it really well in the future. You know, I'd be nice, right. glad to be surprised. And they may be, you know, concerned with being thought of being soft on China. So they may actually say, well, we're going to overdo it. We're going to really be tough. But I don't, you know, if you asked me to give odds on, say, if a Biden administration got in, I'd say there's maybe a 50% chance that we would keep up a sensible policy on China. But until you rein in the financial class that's funding China, I really think our prospects are not good. Long-term, you've got to get a handle on that. And I don't see that happening. So, this is going to get pretty interesting, I think, pretty fast. And, you know, we may find out, you know, soon enough if after the election, whoever wins, if there's a lot of unrest or confusion, you know, you could see China start pushing in a lot of different places and a lot of different ways and take their chances. You know, the stakes have gotten pretty high now. But we'll know a little more next week than we do right now.
Final question. North Korea has gone silent. Is that we're waiting for the American election and then we'll continue? Is that we'll continue to develop our capabilities on the down low until we reach a new threshold with intercontinental ballistic missiles? What do you make of the silence out of the Hermit Kingdom?
Who knows? But I would suggest they're just biding their time. And, you know, they had that military parade the other day,
right.
Which, you know, I think satisfied them for now. But their development has sort of missile technology, weapons development. It has been steadily improving. It's continuing. There's no reason to think it's going to stop. And it's just an engineering problem for them. And that is going to be a continuing and worsening problem that gets harder and harder to deal with. If you don't get your teeth checked immediately and just push it off, when you finally have to deal with it, it's a whole lot worse. And that's where we are with North Korea. So it'll be a problem that will seem very familiar. And it'll continue for a good long while. That should be my way of thinking.
Got it. All right. What are you writing about next?
That's a good one. It may be something like election related. I may wait until the results are in and then weigh in on something. Or I've got some short thing about Palau, inviting the Americans in to set up military bases and to operate from there, which was a nice thing to see a few months ago.
You bet.
So that may be the easy one to knock off.
There you go. And you've seen the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Navy both in Palau here recently. And so, anybody who pays attention knows that. And not only, I mean, if you looked at some of the excerpts from the letter that were written, they want the United States and to, you know, significantly broaden and deepen that relationship and in no uncertain terms. They're very precise about it. So it was, as an American, it's great to see. And one of the Palau Islands is Peleliu, for those of you that don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So we will stand by. But again, what a great development for the United States and the Western Pacific. And hopefully it will be one of again, if we can combine our economic power with those relationships with our need to be strong in the Western Pacific in order to deter, to me that's the winning recipe. So hopefully, maybe we'll see more of that. But we will anxiously await your words as you address
okay.
that. But anyway, no, Grant, I think the piece is a wonderful piece, and you can find the link to it in this post, but the title is China Doesn't Want Deals, It Wants Domination. And I think the first step, again, always in reconciling yourself with the problem is acknowledging that, and that we are beyond the days of the elder Bush saying that the more they you know, cooperate, the more they will become a liberal socialist nation. That is not going to happen. That is not on the agenda. And the world needs to wake up. Certainly the region needs to wake up. And then I think in concert, which I see more indications that we're starting to move that direction, in concert, then we can deal with the Chinese as we dealt with other totalitarian states. But it won't happen. We will all, you know, we will stand, what, we will swing together, or we will all surely hang separately? Hang together.
Yeah, something like hang. Yeah, that's it, Mr. Franklin.
Or yes. Words to that. Or words to that effect. Right. Well, yeah. Grant, first of all, thank you very much for staying up late for us again. We always appreciate the visit. Have a great week.
Okay, thanks a lot.
There you have
okay.
it.
Okay, talk to you later.
You bet. The one and only Grant Newsham here on Wednesday. No, the piece is wonderful. You can find it in AND Magazine, A-N-D. The title, China Doesn't Want Deals, It Wants Domination. I just retweeted it a few seconds ago. And so if, yeah, so take a look at that. You will enjoy the article, I'm sure. So on a Wednesday, that'll do it. In hour one, we talk about a couple things. Information operations relative to police shootings, right? When the police, and I mean, you know, if you weren't discussing this in public, you would say, is it a good kill or is it a bad kill? You know? When they follow the rules of engagement and somebody closes with them with a knife to do them harm, they have the right to defend themselves. That is called a good kill. Not in terms of the morality of taking a life, but in terms of following procedures, were they within their rights, right, as police officers defending themselves. So we talk about that. We'll talk about the World Series. The biggest story coming out of the World Series now is there's two. And one is that the manager of Tampa's baseball team took their best pitcher out when he was having a dominant performance. The second story that is making the rounds via social media is that Justin Turner, who's a huge piece of the Dodger team, finds out in the middle of the game whether he was that he's COVID positive, is immediately removed from the game. I mean, very like shocking. Nobody knew why. Like, what happened? I wonder if he got hurt. And come to find out after the game, there's an announcement that he tested positive. Well, he went back on the field for part of their celebration. So the social media world is aghast at that. So anyway, we talk about that stuff in hour one. So have a great day. The Mensa brothers will join me tomorrow on a Wednesday, All Marine Radio.